Sup, fools? This is the QTR podcast. Today is August 7th, 2018. And today's episode brought to you by my Patreons. If you don't know what Patreon is, it is a website where you can make a recurring donation, as big or as small as you would like, to support the content that you enjoy listening to. So very grateful for those that have signed up for my Patreon. Have some new names that I want to shout out. Joseph Beebe, Julius Fleischer, Matt Pallon, Santo, Bill Williams, Baz Trading, Will DiOrio, Dave West McKisson, Jean Gouli, Carpo Diem, Mark Woolard, Andre Cahan, Craig Gordon, Rob Lipich. Appreciate you guys very much for donating to the Patreon and supporting the content. So let's get right to it today. Not only has today been a shit show over the last couple of hours with the news out of Tesla, but I already had a standing date with one Mr. Roddy Boyd of the Southern Investigative Research Foundation, who's on the line with me. And if you don't know who Roddy Boyd is, he is a journalist that does really surgical and fantastic investigative journalism, mostly on public companies, but also he's done on private companies as well. He has a extensive background in the journalism industry, which I'll let him expound on himself so that I don't fuck it up. And he now has his own outfit, which is a nonprofit called the Southern Investigative Research Foundation that basically writes investigative research on mostly public companies. So, Roddy, why don't you probably do a better job than I would on your own bio. So...
Thanks a lot, Chris.
Do my work for me.
It's a big honor to be here. It's a big honor to be here. I would politely note that the name of the operation is the Southern Investigative Reporting Foundation.
Oh, fuck.
And no, it's all good. It's no problem. Really, it happens a lot. We try and do long-form, document-driven investigative reporting in the public interest. And what we mean by document-driven is I'll spend a lot of time on an investigation coming up with kind of deep research and deep reporting that surfaces from a company's publicly filed documents. Sometimes it can be government regulatory documents or legal, addendums and footnotes. And then from there, I try and find what we call a shoe leather aspect to it, which is I'll go to the company's headquarters or its facilities. I'll try and interview. I'll go around the country trying to interview current and former employees, people litigating or blowing a whistle against the company, share supporters, all kinds of things like that. And we don't surf. No one here short stock. We don't trade stock. There's no economic interest in what we write about. We do it for the simple reason that, in my opinion and the opinion of our board of directors, there's the last 15 years or so have been pretty brutal on financial investigative reporting. In other words, it's the first thing to go when a newspaper or magazine has to retrench and cut its costs. And to that end, we decided to stay in the, our policy is to stand in the gap between a collapsing media and a oftentimes somnolent regulatory framework, in the United States at least. Now, that's pretty high concept. Mostly I do it because I love it. I think it's interesting as hell. It can be challenging. Well, it's challenging every day, and it can be fun. So that's sort of the thumbnail of this thing. The website is sirf-online.org. It's a mouthful, but.
And I'll put I'll put a link to the website in the podcast description too, so people can go and check it out. And also, I want to add that you were one of the very first people to break the Valiant story, and you never got enough credit in my mind for that. I know a lot of people received credit for the Valiant story, but you were one of the first people there on the story, and I don't feel like you got your due with the financial media on that story.
Yeah, I mean, one of the problems with being a small fry is you're a small fry. And so I came from Fortune magazine years back, and had I done that reporting at Fortune, getting credit wouldn't have been a problem because right. the distribution in the soapbox is massive. I'm building the best distribution here. We're building a reputation. It's just going to take time. I mean, when I'm in the same kind of bucket or cohort as people who are also skeptical of Valiant, like John Hempton or Andrew Left, I mean, those guys, of course, they're very different and they have very different approaches, et cetera, and so forth. But they're not retiring types. I'm not going to ever be able to talk past them, and their soapboxes are 200 times bigger than mine. And that's probably a fair thing because they have any number of opinions pro or con at a given time. And I don't. I come out with 4 or 5, I'm trying to get up to 6 stories a year. And it's just not easy for me to wave my little arms and stubby hands fast enough. But I really appreciate your saying that because I busted my hump on the story you're referencing. I spent a couple of months on it and basically felt like the biggest fool on earth. Being so confused, I wasn't even sure that anybody would care or read the darn thing, and it turned out that wasn't really a problem.
It's really got to be. It's really fascinating how sometimes, you know, all the work that you read, and I've told you this privately, the work that you write, I find to be very extraordinarily surgical. I always use that word, meaning it sticks to the facts. It relies heavily on, like you said, publicly disclosed items that are available for any reader to go and check out on their own. And also, you're a very good writer as well. So they're just nice to read. They, you know, they're not difficult. You don't have to kind of bludgeon your way through them. You lay it out, you know, you lay out your case very nice. Why do you think some stories like Valiant wind up taking off where other stories that you've written that I've read, you know, to me seem just as egregious in terms of transgressions and just overall fuckery and shadiness? What does it take for one like Valiant just to get picked up by the mainstream media and to hit the way that it did versus other pieces that you've written that just for some reason they don't get that same kind of traction?
Yeah, I've only spent a good part of my adult life pondering exactly that question. And I don't know I can give you the answer that is clean and discreet and accurate, and it's 2 sentences long. I'll just briefly, going back to the Valiant story, one of the flaws or challenges of working at CERF, Southern Investigative Reporting Foundation, is that I am, apart from Twitter or the phone calls that I make outbound to sources and people I'm trying to interview for a story, I'm completely hermetically sealed off from the world. We're based in Wilmington, North Carolina. And I didn't understand at that time just how much that company was not only a battleground stock, which I define as simply an economic contest of wills between short sellers and longs or equity owners, and of course, jumping from a side to another, the momentum players. That's one thing, but that's 150 stocks, or maybe that's hyperbole, maybe that's 20 companies at a given time I've observed in my career can be that kind of thing. But when Valiant also was the, for want of a better phrase, poster child type of company for something that was equally below the surface, and that was, I I'm going to sound hacky, but it's a healthcare debate. I think Valiant perfectly encapsulated the latent anger in current American society at being systemically, financially, and legally abused by corporations, as well as anger at regulatory inertia. I mean, in that little Netflix documentary I was in, Dirty Money, it really is striking when you see affluent people living in a nice, preppy handbook suburb, five-bedroom house, successful former executives, I believe retired now. In other words, high-net-worth individuals who've essentially gone into hock to buy a rare disease drug for Wilson's disease, you know, put out by Valiant. I mean, what I'm trying to say is it was a company at a point in time that people were able to look at and say, that's exactly what I'm angry about.
Right.
Not only are these guys utterly beyond ruthless in gaming the system, because you can make arguments, there's free market arguments you can make that, look, their job, I mean, for all his faults, and he has many, many faults, Martin Shkreli did make a cogent argument, narrowly at least, about, I'm CEO of a publicly traded company. My job is to maximize returns for the people who have taken equity stakes in my entity. This wasn't that. This was gaming the system, and then you have something like that Philidor, you know, the nonsense that Valiant got up to behind it. And it really, you know, you have the people at a major hedge fund, you know, the Mavericks and the Blue Ridges and the Permian, you know, large, sophisticated operations sitting there with big chunks, to say nothing of Pershing Square, a lot of bright, talented, hardworking people. And they're, you know, they're like, what on earth is going on? And on the other side, you have, you know, that story resonated in Wilmington, North Carolina, which is at best a very middle-class place. And I didn't fully understand that at the time, because I just get caught up making my phone calls and studying my documents. And I was as physically sick to my stomach putting that story out as I've ever been in my career, because I figured, A, no one might care. I mean, this is, you know, that's a pretty complex story. And then B, if at any level, after months of travel and work and knocking on doors and showing up unannounced in front of people's houses on a weekend to reporting the damn thing, if I'm wrong, oh my God. I mean, the money that company, you know, could bring to bear on some little surf. I mean, holy cow, I was pretty had a good sized hole in my stomach, you know, that day in October.
And let me just go back to one thing that you said about Martin Shkreli. You know, you can say what you want about Martin Shkreli, and you know, ultimately the dude's in jail and he was convicted on several of the fraud charges. But when it comes to the business model that he was running at Retrofin, he wasn't doing anything different than what, you know, HZMP and VRX and all these other, you know, Mylan and all these other companies, and Mallinckrodt is still running the same model. Okay, which was based off of Questcor, who was one of the originators of this model.
I mean,
you know, Questcor went out and bought this drug for $200,000. And then marked it up to $40,000 a vial, marked it up something, you know, absurd, 50 times whatever they were charging prior, and then tried to start using it for all these different indications for which there isn't a bunch of clinical efficacy for. And they took a $200,000 drug and they turned it into a, you know, several billion dollar company that they sold that ultimately wound up becoming a $15 billion company, you know, that went to 120 and then came all the way back down to 10. All based on that same model. And they're still, you know, Mallinckrodt, the stock was up 10% today on sales of this Acthar. They're still running that fucking model.
I mean, I There's a guy on Twitter, his name is Adam Feuerstein, and Adam is a true legend in life sciences reporting, pharma reporting, and he was as eloquent as anybody could be, saying Shkreli, what he did at Retrofin was much less appalling when you sit down clearly, remove the emotional component to it.
Take the name off of it.
Were personally and, disgusting.
Right.
But if you look at the amount of people that Big Pharma has killed happily, you can't compare the two. And I'm not trying to do that. And I don't think the job of my of Surf nor this podcast. But if you just want to get down to brass knuckles, the white, you know, Pfizer, Merck, Johnson & Johnson, all those neat little massive corporations that lobby so hard in the dark are truly more troubling than Martin Shkreli's unmedicated, untreated ramblings late at night in social media.
And let's talk about another company that you wrote about where, you know, your reporting may have saved lives, and that's Insys. And don't be like fucking modest about it, because we've had this conversation off the podcast where, you know, we've talked about this at length, and I've complimented you on your reporting on Insys. And, you know, I had a very frank talk with you about it one day. I don't know if you remember, probably 6 months ago, where I told you, you know, I said, I know people that have had opioid addictions, and, you know, we all know people that have dealt with their own addiction problems. And a company like Insys that takes a drug like fentanyl, which for people that are not familiar with it, was the drug that ultimately wound up killing Prince, and is basically, it's a opioid like painkiller, and I'll let you describe it more, but intensified by a factor of something like 100. It's literally some of the strongest shit that you can get. And they start prescribing it off-label. It was intended only for, I believe, terminally ill cancer patients. And you can correct me if I'm wrong. But one way or another, they started prescribing it off-label. And there were internal company documents that actually made jokes about, you know, take whatever will kill somebody and prescribe them just a little bit less than that. And you wrote a fantastic series on them called Murder Incorporated, I believe, which if you haven't read, I would recommend that you put on your reading list, just because it's a beautiful piece of reporting. And ultimately, the chickens came home to roost there, and you may have done some serious help in saving lives. Do you want to tell me a little bit about that story and how you got it and all the shit that I just got wrong now describing it?
No. No. First of all, thanks a lot. You and I definitely talked about it. You've been very generous privately as well as publicly. I don't know if I can say I saved lives. I know I can say that I played a part in stopping bad guys.
You saved lives. I'm telling you saved lives. Because they would still be out there prescribing this shit. Just take the compliment, all right?
Yeah. Amen. And, you know, one hopes, you know, your lips, God's ears. It's going back into the Christmas of 2014. Let's say it's December of 2014. One day I got a package at the door from a source who's also a friend. I try to keep the two separate, and I try and keep it very professional, but on occasion you just become friends with somebody, and the guy I was friends with sent me a little package based on some initial public document scans he had done on Insys. And I'll never forget the day, because I was in bed with one of those late Christmas time cold flu thing happening, and it's one of those deals where you can't take enough NyQuil simply to just make it go away and stay asleep. And my wife came into bed and was just like, you know, honey, you got this package. And I was like looking at it. I couldn't believe the numbers. the prescription growth of this thing, you know, this oral formulation of fentanyl. It looks exactly like an asthma inhaler that all of us would recognize, except instead of taking like Ventolin or something like that, or Asthmaquart, some steroid, it's a formulation of fentanyl that's about 100 times more powerful than the type of morphine you would get for a surgical procedure. The hook, as if that wasn't enough, it's as an aerosol, as an oral formulation, it goes, it bypasses your bloodstream and goes right into your lungs, which just puts it on the express elevator to your brain. So I analogize it as what it does to your heart. That it's like pulling the emergency brake on a subway car, or quite frankly, putting, you know, popping the clutch or the emergency brake on a car going, you know, 60 miles an hour. Yeah, you'll slow down all right, but a lot of people slow down, so it can't take. It's really something else. And I just was looking at this prescription growth at that time. I as the story went, I just said, look, I am so sick right now. I'm not seeing these numbers right. I know my head is swimming. You can't grow this fast in that market. There is a special FDA protocol on this drug called a REMS, a risk assessment, risk something mitigation system. And it was designed to make it hard to prescribe it off-label, and it was designed to only be used for what they call breakthrough cancer pain, which is essentially palliative care, where you're in such pain that formulations of morphine or hydrocodone will not work. And maybe you're so sick you can't take a fentanyl lollipop, or you can't take any other kind of drug. So this would bypass that. And I think it's completely valid as far as that goes. The problem is once I got my wits about me in a few days and saw that I wasn't hallucinating, and they really were growing that fast, I made some phone calls and was told by a bunch of veteran pharma execs that marketplace might be $60 million a year in the U.S., all 50 states, and that includes VA hospitals and nursing homes. I mean, every place that sort of congregates people who die, you know, where there's large masses, hospices and stuff like that. You're not looking at $50 to $60 million, and you know they're telling investors they're looking to grow it to about $250-$300 million. So when I just did that math and said, well, they're growing at 400% above let's say the natural cancer rate. You know, cancer is going to track population growth, seemingly. I was like, boy, this is going to be a story. And I just got on LinkedIn and started finding former executives who, I mean, they were all scared and they felt like they'd been in the middle of something wrong, largely, of course, because they had been. But I just kept on saying, well, hey, that's all great. That's a remarkable tale. Can we find a way to get me some of those documents, some of these crazy emails from the head of sales saying, if you start, you know, if a patient of yours starts at the FDA prescribed limit for this drug, you and I will have a personal phone call within 12 hours, and you have to explain to me why he or she isn't on something 3 to 4 times that. If we have a couple of them, consider yourself resigned, because you'll hear from human resources. And he backed that up. And when I started getting those emails, I knew that I really was onto a story. And then, of course, they're able to track that into what ProPublica calls dollars for docs, or more properly, via the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, they have a website called Open Payments where you can run screens to see what pharmaceutical companies are paying doctors and what for. And INSYS was, I mean, it was a jailbreak. It was insane. They were paying their leading prescribers, who were 30, 40, 50% of their revenues in certain quarters. They were paying them $100,000 a year for, and this is a company that's only been in the marketplace for 2 years now. I mean, it was remarkable. And then from there, I went out to California and Arizona in the summer, and went retail, because I knew this was an important story. I was talking to a lot of people. I'd found some support groups along the way of people who had lost loved ones, usually children, to the opioid, what we now call the opioid crisis, but 3 or 4 years ago, they didn't really have a name. And I went to doctors' houses, I went to doctors' practices, I actually sat in two of these pill mills, and it very much was one of the defining experiences of my life. It's really a center of human misery. I mean, people are slouched over, they're drooling. These are well-established anesthesiologists who just sort of made a decision to prescribe substance as well as other drugs without heed to diagnosis. And I should tell you that I'm going to write a book about this.
I was gonna, you know, what's funny is I was gonna ask if you were gonna write a book about Valiant, but you're gonna write a book about INSYS.
I'm gonna write a book about it. I'm actually working on it right now.
It's about what? Just about INSYS or about INSYS and Valiant?
It's about INSYS. Okay. The working title is "Adverse Events."
Oh, okay.
A corporate horror story, and that's a reference to a very key document, or key database that I tracked in my INSYS reporting, which is the FDA's adverse events.
That's the FAERS database. Yeah, I've been on there.
Yeah, and you were able to look at the reports of hospitalization and overdose and death using this. Now, of course, there's some of these people with cancer, and it's late stage cancer, and there's a high morbidity component to it, and that's to be expected. What wasn't expected was the fact that it would appear, in retrospect, a good number or the majority of users were simply people who had other pains who wanted to medicate them away, which, again, I understand. We've all been in pain, and we've all needed that. But I would suspect that whatever your back pain is, taking something 100 times stronger than operating room morphine would be ill-advised. And then a sizable minority of people were, at some level, people who were addicted. And that's excellent business model to the extent that they can stay alive. As the head of sales noted in a presentation to new salespeople in 2015, it blows away tobacco for the stickiness of its user base, and that's because it's the last drug they'll ever take, and that's really sad. That was really sad. So
yeah, the whole situation is sad, and like I said, you did a fantastic job reporting it. I would be really interested in reading the book if you publish it. You did write a book also about the financial crisis as well, right?
Yes.
Called Fatal Risk.
Yeah, about the collapse of AIG and using that as a template or a way into explaining how even the best governed and most well-respected, or seemingly best governed and seemingly very well-respected companies can do truly absurd, truly irrational things, and I think AIG was a good way of looking at that. Having said that, it's an insurance company, and trying to make an insurance company exciting was difficult, but I think AIG was such an interesting, far-flung, important company to the global financial system that it was a valid exploration.
Well, it was really exactly it was considered it was considered to be like the linchpin, right? I mean, if AIG gave out, they expected the whole fucking system to come down.
Fulcrum, yeah.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, that makes it kind of exciting if it on its back rests the entire global economic system. Probably worth noting a couple of things there, right? What was really one or two of the most surprising things that you learned in the process of writing that book?
One of the things my wife and I were just talking about the other day, it was a really bitter pill to swallow then and now. Every reporter has this problem that you try and connect with former or even current employees and, hey, could you tell me what's really going on? Can you give me documents? Can you just hear me out? Is this crazy? All the things you'd expect a reporter to try and explore. It was incredible how many people would not talk to me in the course of AIG reporting because they had received very comprehensive NDAs, non-disclosure agreements, upon right. leaving AIG, and accompanying that were oftentimes very generous payouts, the more so given the fact that these people had just left a ship that was technically bankrupt. They had been bailed out by the New York branch of the Federal Reserve and later the Department of Treasury. And so I actually sat there one day and realized people weren't able to talk. I'm not talking, you know, people wanted to talk. Some of them could be, and I noted it in the book, some of them broke their agreements, and I am eternally grateful for about four or five of those people. But it's incredible to think that people can't discuss publicly ever, apart from a Department of Justice subpoena, what happened there. Because the taxpayers paid their bonus. Those people, AIG used the first round of bailout money to pay those NDAs. And now, granted, I'm sure all in, it's probably $75 million, and that's a rounding error for a company that needed about $170 billion to get right-sized, to say nothing of selling 38% of it of itself, but it was truly a bitter pill to think that our money went to keeping the real nasty stuff a secret. The other thing was just getting back into it. The other thing was that just it was too big to manage, and it kept on. I just kept on hearing that from board members, which is a strange thing when you're hearing it from a member of the company, of the board of directors, who are saying, "Oh, it was just too big to manage." But I stuck around anyhow. And it was okay. Well, yeah, nothing like a commitment to governance, huh?
Right.
And then next to that, you had the company had very odd reporting systems, so it would be 3 hours before quarter end, and they were still tallying up earnings per share. And the former CEO, a guy named Robert Willemstad, who had taken over in the depths of the credit crisis, he was a 35-year Citigroup right-hand man to Sandy Weill at Citigroup, and then before that, Citicorp. He said to me that if, let's say, their prop desk or their government or even their mortgage desk rates went against them and they took an intraday $500 million mark to market, he had given his enterprise-wide access to data. He said it was three keystrokes to know what that $500 million markdown on the trading floor amounted to were the quarter to end that day. Would that be 4 cents a share? Would that be 2 cents? I don't know. But he said he just assumed that AIG, given its reputation, that everybody in the world knew Hank Greenberg and then Martin Sullivan were smarter than Sandy Weill.
Right.
He just assumed that AIG had 20 times better than that. That, you know, if they bought a round of drinks in Singapore for, you know, a customer, he could see the fractional cost, you know, as it accrued up the, to earnings as they accrued up the ladder there. And it was the precise opposite. They were reconciling hedge funds and investments in buildings in Africa and Russia. They were trying to get fair market value to those things literally hours before the quarter shut. And he said it almost made him physically ill. He thought that it was a joke when the first time he was told. And he had to be told repeatedly that it was not a joke. That they didn't have a sort of unified enterprise-wide accounting system.
Right.
I'm not sure what that would look like, you know, God's own Excel spreadsheet. I have no idea. But I mean, that's their job to know that. And that as much as anything else blows me the hell away. Just that they, so that's how you can get $39 billion of mortgage-backed securities, I should say, at best, Alt-A or, you know, mid-prime, as they used to call it, most likely subprime, mortgage-backed security stuffed into their life insurance companies. You know, they had that big stock loan scandal where instead of they took all the cash from their stock loan and stock borrow operation that they had gotten on the hypothecation, and instead of putting it in, you know, 60-day treasuries or something like that, they had the big idea to capture a whole lot of carry by throwing it into higher-yielding mortgage-backed securities. And they didn't tell anybody about it. And they put that was held in the life insurance. Like, you know, Grandpa dies, and he had a $250,000 whole loan insurance. Well, you know, obviously no insurance company keeps all that cash in the drawer. They take your premiums and they invest it.
Right.
And they, boy, oh boy, you know, they made quite a mistake there. I mean, I remember talking to people at the New York Fed. The New York Fed was just like, you did what? Like, they didn't understand it. They just thought that there was a misunderstanding and they were the people because they were the government bureaucrats. I remember talking to the general counsel of the New York Fed, and he told me, he said, look, I didn't understand it, and I had to have people explain it to me once people here got it. He's like, people, their hands were shaking. They were like, this can't be happening. this is the core insurance company. You know, people are going to die and not be able to get their payouts.
Right.
And that's when that happens, you start seeing a whole lot of mid-America start going belly up. And that, as much as anything, forced Geithner's hand, and then eventually it forced Paulson's hand.
Where were you?
I suspect is more than you care about. But
No. I like hearing it. Where were you working at the time?
I had just been let go of Fortune magazine, and they fired a bunch of reporters, and I was one of them. And I was just sitting on my keister. I was living in Greenwich, Connecticut, where I'm from at the time. And I decided, well, hey, this is going to be a good book. You know, people are going to care about this. Like all reporters, you sell yourself a bill of goods.
Right.
The stuff I'm interested in is going to be very interesting to the American public.
Right.
Boy, John Stewart's going to get a hold of this. He's going to take it to town. I just know it.
Right.
You know, like, yeah, that's a bit of delusion I sold myself. But, the deeper, complex things that other people ignore is what I love to investigate and report on. Getting other people to love it and to read it and then to either pay me for it or donate is a, you know, a vastly different enterprise, one that I'm probably ill-suited to pursue. But I just love the story from the from the get-go.
Look,
I mean, one of the guys
might not be necessarily true, because I thought the same thing when I started the podcast. Right,
yeah.
Which is just that I'm just going to start creating from scratch, and I'm going to talk about whatever it is that I'm interested in, and I'm not going to talk about anything that I'm not interested in. And if people want to listen, that's fine. And if they don't want to listen, that's fine too. Nobody's listening now that I don't have a podcast, so I really don't have anything to lose. So when I started the podcast, I mean, I had the same attitude, which is, you know, look, we'll just see if people start to catch on. And I think, you know, people have started to listen, and I've gotten a little bit of a base. And I think that Surf is probably also the same way, because I see people on Twitter talking about it that are not being provoked by you or provoked by me or provoked by, you know, somebody that you're close to who knows about it. And it does get some attention. And you did, you know, I know you got some CNBC time back during the Valiant days. And when you publish, it makes an impact. It's a headline. So I think, you know, look, I think with the way that the media is going right now, Roddy.
Yeah.
With, you know, back in the day, it used to be you had to watch ABC, NBC, or CBS, and you had to read one of three newspapers. And if your content wasn't there, then you were shit out of luck. And now the opposite is happening. Content is ubiquitous, because everybody has the power to publish it on their own, put it out there on their own. So your work is gonna stand on its own. The work is superlative, right? So eventually people will start to take notice. And I think once the gate starts to swing in the other direction and you get some momentum behind you, you know, I think you already have some momentum, but I think that'll pick up. And, I think you're going to get there. You just stick with it.
Yeah. I mean, I turned around the other day and I realized I've been doing this for 6 years.
Yeah.
And we're making it, you know, we're getting there. It's a work in process. But I'm confident. I think eventually we'll be able to grow and build and do the kind of work that I think is important. And so, certainly congratulations are in order for your success. And I'm trying. You know, I'm trying to get out there.
The toughest part is when you're just getting started. You know.
Oh, sure.
In anything, it's not just being a content creator. It's in business. It's in anything. The toughest part is going from the idea and the vision to, getting to that point where you got the wheels turning, you have a little bit of momentum. You really have some powerhouses on your board of directors at Surf, huh?
Yeah, I mean, Bethany and I have known each other a long time. Bill Cohen is, I'd say, one of the – Bethany McLean and Bill Cohen both work at Vanity Fair. Their staff writers there, and Bill has had a remarkable career after leaving investment banking as a chronicler of these massive financial enterprises, whether it's Lazard Frere or Goldman Sachs or Bear Stearns. He's also written a lot of stuff. And then Chris Rausch at the board of directors. He's the head of the financial journalism program at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And we're, sadly, one of my role models in my life, Christopher Byron, who I worked with at the New York Post business desk. He passed away in January of 17. So I am trying to, we'll get another board member, and we'll be a fully constituted board again. And I'm grateful. They've been very supportive. I Surf governance, we take it very seriously. We are an investigative reporting soup kitchen. So we work for kicks. without using hyperbole or any of that, I'm sure I would be the lousiest hedge fund manager in the history of hedge funds. But if I just simply wanted to do what a lot of people do, which is trade based on their research and reporting, I think I could turn a penny And we leave all that there because we try and do things in public interest. And it doesn't make me a great person. It doesn't make my reporting good, but it at least you understand that where I'm coming from. So my hope is Bethany and Bill and Chris really do feel the mission and care deeply about it. And their counsel and support it's been remarkable. I am grateful at a molecular level for it, on a deep, deep level.
What do you think that investigative reporting and skeptical journalism in the financial world has just disappeared? I mean, you could argue now, 10 years into a bull market, it's far more necessary than it's ever been to look at things, if not with just a different perspective, a critical eye. But it just seems that there aren't that many journalists out there that want to do it, or they've either been let go or they don't exist, or I don't really know. I look at guys like Charlie Grant, who does great work, and I just wonder why, and certainly he's one of a staff of writers at the Wall Street Journal.
Sure.
Certainly. He's a fantastic. Yeah. But why do you think there aren't a lot of guys like him out there? Why do you think that investigative reporting in the financial world is now kind of, that torch is being carried more by, like you're saying, hedge funds doing research and less by traditional journalists?
I have pretty strong feelings on that. It's because it's costly, time-consuming, and difficult to do right. And so based on that, I work 3 months out of story, and it's not like I call it term paperitis, where you kind of goof around and go out and party and have a little fun for 6 weeks, and then around November start writing your term papers. It's not like that. Like, you're back in school. I'll put in 5, 6, 7 days a week of 10-12 hour days on a story for a few months in a row. I mean, it's not always 7 days a week. I don't want to use hyperbole here, but it's difficult. And then you hit the road, or you try and fight the government for Freedom of Information Act stuff, or you're arguing lawyers to show you documents or to clarify certain things. So it's a lot easier to sit there and snark on Jamie Dimon. Or whatever the hell is going on at Goldman Sachs, the horse race there, to be, the next Lloyd Blank. Fine, obviously that's settled. That I believe the name is Dave Solomon. But I mean, you can. I certainly have a little fun on Twitter. I try and do it with a decent nature most of the time. But it's easy to sit there and carp about, hey, this analyst says that, or Tesla did this. It's a lot easier to do that than sit there and figure out, well, what the hell is Tesla really doing? And what the hell is this company doing, or that company? And so rather than pay that reporter $100,000, $150,000 or more, it's a lot easier to bring in a 24-year-old or 25 or 27-year-old and say, look, just make it happen. Go out there and get stories. Be safe. And companies, I mean, I can Seth pays a lot of money to its lawyers and for insurance every year. And for a big newsroom that's had a lot of economic stress, like the Wall Street Journal, their appetite for risk has sharply dropped. Now, I am not saying for a second there isn't great reporters there who are doing a lot of good work. I mean, if you just look at what they did with, John Carreyrou did with Theranos and some other reporters did on other stories. Charlie has been fantastic with Tesla and a few others. But the place isn't what it was. And that's because they simply don't have the ability to take good reporters and tell them, get on this. Let's talk in 2 weeks. And I don't want to say for, I would like to make clear to your audience, I don't always spend 2-3 months on a story. Sometimes I can turn it around quicker than that, but I'm just saying it's a lot easier to put somebody on the, you know, on the Bank of America call and live tweet it than it is to sit there and pull apart their treasury operations and see, well, oh yeah, they're a huge catch to, I'm making this up now, you know, it turns out they've got a lot of money hypothecated, so their cash position isn't exactly what they say it is, or there's risks here that aren't being disclosed, or those sorts of things. I mean, it's really not easy work. I try and go around and put on presentations to teach other journalists and young financial skeptics of every stripe some of the things I look at, and maybe that'll help. Maybe that'll get some people interested. I think probably, as you know, my family members have said to me that I am I'm probably a saddle maker of decent talent in an era of the automobile. Yeah, I mean, maybe just people care about other things these days. I don't know.
Yeah, what do you think is going on with Tesla? So we have to talk about this, right? CEO comes out and makes this tweet today that he's considering taking the company private at $420 a share, and then he writes funding secured, and then a half hour later, everybody's still trying to figure out whether or not it's Elon Musk that put the tweet out. Then Ross Gerber, who's an investor in the company, seems to be the first one that confirms that the tweet was from the company before the mainstream media even picks it up. Next thing you know, the stock is halted 30 minutes later after it's up probably 10 or 15 bucks higher than it was after it had already risen on a Saudi investment story from Financial Times that came out. Then the stock is halted. Then the company releases this statement, which is supposedly an email that Musk sent to his employees early this morning saying that he's considering the company going private at $420 a share, but doesn't say anything about funding. So what's your take on the story and today? And
I mean, only Elon Musk could make something like this so complicated. I mean, anybody else could presumably just put out a point-blank signed and enumerated statement saying we're seeking to go private at right. this number. We have secured financing of X billions of dollars. The process, here's who's advising us. Here is the outline of our reasons why, and move on about it. But he's not that guy. Maybe it's just not that kind of company. Look, there's about 170 million shares outstanding. He wants to go private at 420 a share. That's 70 something billion. I mean, he owns what, 19% of it? So maybe he doesn't sell into it, but I mean, boy oh boy, those mutual funds and some of those speculators, I mean, you're going to turn down a 20% kiss to own a fractional ownership in a private company that won't have any, I guess, governmentally imposed rules, at least for financial reporting and disclosure. And I don't know about that. I mean, I could see him having to come up with $40 billion. I mean,
That was my guess.
Yeah, I mean,
where do you get $40 billion in equity capital before we even address any of the other things that I want to address?
Yeah, well, so, I mean, I haven't really followed Tesla, but I won't either. It truly is too captivating to me to pass by and be agnostic about. So I kind of dive into it from time to time and make random notes in my notes file. And I think he owns, what, 20%?
I think so, yeah.
So let's just say 20 because it's the number I have to hand. And so I believe he probably can, I don't want to say speak for, but he has influence over another 10%. Maybe it's sovereign wealth funds.
More than likely, you're accurate, right?
Yeah. Okay. So So I give that a, you know, I'll take that out of the mix. I suspect that some of those mutual fund holders can hold up to, I think, 5% private. If they were sheepish enough to hold this long, they're probably committed at some level. They'll hold. I just, again, it's a back of the envelope thing, but I bet he only has to get, and I say only with air quotes, 38, 40, 45 billion. I mean, if it was over that, I don't think you could be shocked. Because again, you're looking at a 20% takeout, and that's going to be attractive to a lot of holders. It's designed to be attractive to a lot of holders. So then you're looking at, well, what's the imputed interest rate?
Well, the guys that are in there buying Tesla at $360 a share, two of the biggest bulls that I know, Ross Gerber and Galileo Russell. I mean, Galileo said he's holding for a $1 trillion market cap, and Ross Gerber came on my podcast and said he was looking for a 10x when the stock was at 300. So how appealing is a 20% premium going to be to those people?
Yeah, so I mean, so that if they have all of the requisite psychological and intestinal abilities, the fortitude to pass by, that if they're looking at a $3,000 per share private or public valuation, then okay. So maybe there's other people like him. I'm sure there are, truly evangelical in their thinking. Let's say it's another 10 to 15% of the shares outstanding. Well, there's still a lot of people who are going to sell. So, I mean, even if it's 35 billion or 30 billion, it's still a lot of money. Then you have to argue, well, where are you on the, what's that going to cost notionally? I mean, when they got cut to B3 by Moody's, the imputed interest rate was about, what, 7.25% was the yield that it was trading for?
Yeah, it was something like that.
Let's just say you have to raise $30 billion, okay? Because there's a lot of Ross Gerbers and the other gentleman. You'll forgive me, I'm dropping his name right now, but I'll stipulate that they have good intentions and that they're men of their word. So, that's still $2 billion of interest expense
right
alone. Plus, it's $2 billion plus. On a company that through the first 6 months of this year burned $528 million in operating cash. And it's a company that has a history of problematic assertions and confusing or perhaps distracted expenditures. And without at least some market discipline being imposed on them, I think that might be a bit more complex of an investment. I'm trying to be as fair as I can. I mean, I think there's a part of me that really wants electric cars out there, and I've long thought that the big three and the competitors from Europe and Asia, I think they're probably best placed to solve this, but maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. That, I mean, this company already has, what, $9 billion of debt outstanding?
Yeah, something like that.
I mean, so they're already hard put. And I'm trying to be as nice as I can to this, but if you're going to throw another $2 billion in what's going to be fixed expense before you get to repaying principal, I mean, look, maybe it all works out. I don't know. And then the Hyperloop kicks in and the flamethrowers, and you throw in SpaceX and maybe that the solar panels, all of it works out. But I'm guessing that's not going to be the case. And magic thinking isn't really magical thinking doesn't really pay principal and interest. So I don't know. I mean, I'm sure that, I mean, Elon Musk has been writing a very long letter for a on a short piece of paper for a while here, right? he's been telling people that he doesn't want to be a public CEO anymore.
Right.
He wants to be able to post pictures of flaming shots in a Tel Aviv bar or something like that.
Tough shit for him because, you know, he took the company public, and Herb Greenberg made a great tweet today, and I forget what it said verbatim, but something akin to a point that I make all the time, which is, you look, being public is a privilege, okay? So if you're going to take all of the benefits of being a public company, which is increased spotlight on the company, increased coverage in the media, better access to capital, you have to deal with all the negative points of being a public company, which is public scrutiny on your financials, public scrutiny on your fucking business, okay? And so, and what he needs to realize, which I tried to make this point in my Montana Skeptic podcast, is that just as you're going to have people out there that are going to hang on every single thing that he does and they're going to love everything that he does, when you become a public company and you open the books and you open the doors up to the whole world, okay, because everybody and their brother one way or another through 6 degrees of separation has exposure to this company's fucking equity, whether it's through their pension fund or through some stupid ETF they own or whatever, you have to be able to deal with the other side of the spectrum as well, which is you're going to have sharp fucking guys like Jim Chanos, you know, that go in, that look at the financials, guys like Mark Spiegel, who understand the financial reality of this company versus the narrative, the ideology, the philosophy, and all the other happy horseshit that's been sold to the people that don't look at quarterly filings for a living, that aren't CFAs, that, you know, that are looking at the company through the lens of what its mission is versus what its tangible return on investment is. And so Musk has to understand as a CEO that when you're a public company, you know, you have to take the good with the bad. And this notion now that when shit is getting rough on him, and, you know, I just find the whole thing comical. Okay, so let's just start with what you said at first. The first thing you said is I don't understand why they wouldn't just go out and, you know, any other company would have considered an offer if there was an offer. The board would have met about it. There would have been resolutions signed, this, that, and the other, conference calls and meetings, late nights in the boardroom. And they would have consulted with a securities attorney who would have, you know, helped them prepare the pertinent disclosure documentation, whether it is a, you know, probably a Form 8K and with an exhibit and a term sheet or whatever the fuck it is, you know. And what they would do is they would meet about it. They would meet with their PR and their IR. They put together a game plan, which is we're going to put out the press release the next morning. We're going to file the corresponding 8K that day with the press release as an exhibit. And that will be that, you know, and if we halt the stock, we're going to do it well in advance. Instead, what we saw here was, you know, Musk comes out and tweets whatever he wants. And then all of a sudden, the stock trades for a half hour on this news that only some people, if you have Twitter, are entitled to, as the mainstream media spends a half hour trying to figure out whether fuck this guy is tweeting from his own account or it's been hacked, because nobody even knows whether or not it's Elon Musk saying this. Meanwhile, the stock is going up, it's going down, you know, there's millions of shares are trading. And then finally, a half hour later, they halt the stock, and then they roll out this statement maybe a half hour, 45 minutes after that, which doesn't have anything in it about the funding that this guy talked about in his tweet. Why are they doing business like that when everybody else in the public company world, when there is an offer or a considered offer or they're considering strategic alternatives or somebody shows interest, can go out and can do it in an order that's responsible, that discloses the information to investors all at once? Why is this company so incapable of doing that?
I have no idea. I mean, they have access to everyone and everything you just laid out. And if they want that adrenaline pop of watching that stock go up 30, 40 points in pay, they can get that and more by doing it the right way. It's ridiculous.
Right.
I mean, it seems so contrary to their self-interest.
And then for this guy to tweet out good morning after that, Like he tweeted it out and he's just enjoying sitting back watching the response from the market and the response from the media while everybody and their brother tries to figure out what the fuck is going on. And he's sitting there tweeting out smiley faces. It just, you know, look, to me, it gave me the impression that the company did not know he was going to disclose that today.
Well, I mean, that's like 11 million times worse than anything we're discussing. If you're not telling people
do you think the company knew that he was going to disclose that today when he did? In your opinion, based on the order of how that went down today?
I don't know. I have to guess that they're not that much of a popcorn operation, that they're just the kind of seat that's like NASDAQ stuff circa 1998, where some idiotic self-promoting small cap CEO gets out there and announces he's going to go take over eBay or some crap. I mean, I'd really like to believe, despite the massive circumstantial evidence to the contrary, that Elon Musk is a much more serious man than what you just framed.
Well, I'd like to believe it too. I'd like to believe he's playing fucking eight-dimensional chess and he's 15 moves ahead of us. our puny pea brains just don't understand. But more and more increasingly, of late, calling this guy a pedophile and all this shit, it just seems like maybe he isn't even playing chess. Maybe he's playing fucking checkers, or maybe he doesn't even. And it's not a slight.
Rolling dice, yeah.
Yeah, it's not a slight at his intelligence, because I genuinely think he's a very smart person. But as I've said on the podcast before, I think he has either a misconception about the way that the public markets work, or he wasn't fully informed on what being a public company entails. He certainly doesn't seem to have any care for what the proper way of doing things may be.
Yeah. I mean, I look back on it. So like I was saying to you before, Chris, I put on these little seminars for other reporters, and one of the things I tell them in the first slides is to look at the April 2016 announcement by Tesla that they are, I pulled the language, that they've achieved core operational cash flow of about $179 million. I mean, the stock went up like it was parabolic. I mean, talk about a hockey stick, right? And that was, if you recall, about the time that people were really beginning to question whether Tesla was going to be able to fulfill any of those promises. I think they had just taken Solar City, and it was all kinds of questions about them. And they made up, I mean, I call it financial Esperanto. There is no such thing as core operational cash flow. It's a ridiculous recipe of a bunch of non-serious inputs. For example, they were building, April 2016, they were still building a lot of stuff, but they left out CapEx.
Right.
So at the end of it, instead of being nearly $180 million generating of this core operational cash flow, the actual cash flow was, or a burn of $232 million. And it was the all-time, boy, I mean, those people who had been picking up the shares, you know, around that time, what a Christmas or present that was. But I mean, it really does illustrate that they will tolerate, to put that out, I really don't understand how the SEC hasn't, that's an easy one, okay? That is a very easy thing.
What is?
You need to,
it's a layup for the SEC, right?
Yeah.
Think about the fucking individual investor, okay? Think about the individual investor who is not a CFA, who's not a CPA, who doesn't have a finance degree, who doesn't have an economics degree, who has a Robinhood account, who's investing in the story, who's a good person, who works, you know, some type of working class job, who's a fucking welder that lives next door to me in Philadelphia, who's trying to invest in the story, who cracks open that press release or sees the way it's reported by one of the outfits that picks it up afterwards, and sees, you know, non-GAAP core operational cash flow positive, whatever. you know, to that person, that might as well be the company's profitable. I mean, nobody's differentiating between that. It's only fucking people that are in the know that, okay, well, there's a word there that, you know, prior to cash flow that really indicates there may be some fuckery going on. And it's the same deal with them, you know, the argument that a lot of short sellers are making about the company's gross margin and what's being tucked into gross margin, what isn't being tucked into gross margin, what's being capitalized and what isn't being capitalized. So where is the SEC? I did a podcast a couple months ago when he came out and announced, A, that they wouldn't need to raise capital this year, and B, that they would be GAAP profitable this year. I made the point that if they aren't, I thought the SEC should look into them. But where is the SEC? I mean, this stuff today. How about this one, Roddy, okay? How about this? If they don't file an 8K within 3 days of this tweet today that indicates how and where that funding was secured, is that not actionable?
I would think that would be taught in securities law classes as the case study for violation, you know, of security price manipulation. I don't know, notwithstanding the free speech argument, he can say whatever he wants, but I mean, that is a material disclosure that you are seeking. He had the price in there of $420. He had a reasoning. I don't care if it, you know, doesn't matter what his reasoning is. He disclosed it. They did not seek to take the communication back. I'm sure there are lawyers on this, you know, listening to your podcast. I'm sure there are veteran market operators of you know, either side of the trade. But this would seem to violate wholesale components of the 34 Act.
Well, I would say that it would if within 3 days. I think they have 3 business days to file an 8K to expound on what he said. So this is akin to a company releasing earnings and not filing the 10Q, right? You have a certain amount of days to do it.
Yeah.
But they have to. They're going to have to address the fact that he said that funding is secured. There's no way around that, right? They're going to put out an 8K about it or not. It's like this Chinese plan that they have and this memorandum of understanding or whatever it was that they signed that they didn't put out an 8K for either. So if there's no 8K, what does that mean? Does it mean that they're just not good at disclosure, or that it doesn't exist?
You would have to conclude that it doesn't exist. And then from then on in, it's just, I mean, my God, if he were to do, again, I'm trying to see this in the best light. I'm sure they have a reason for doing what they're doing. But if this were to be put out, I wonder, the problem wouldn't be Musk. I would have to say it's their board of directors.
Of course.
And how could this be tolerated that they would, this conduct? I mean, I'm not sure why they didn't go the 8K official corporate announcement route from day one on this. This is day one, but from the get. But notwithstanding that, I wonder, God, I hope for them, because it would almost be a Department of Justice problem, right? I mean, at that point,
well, it becomes really egregious, and it becomes so egregious that the layperson can understand. You know, if you capitalize something that shouldn't be capitalized on the balance sheet, that's accounting fuckery that, you know, a normal person may not understand. So it's not going to spark public outrage. But if you come out and say funding is secured for a bid to take the company private at $420 a share, and then, you know, somebody asks you where the funding is, and you turn around and you hand them a fucking Domino's pizza, they're gonna realize that something's wrong there. I mean, that's the kind of fuckery that anybody can understand. So, like you said, you're assuming the best here. I have to assume the best, too. They have 3 days to file an 8K. But, you know, if they don't, I think they leave themselves in a very actionable position.
Yeah, I don't know what their defense could be were they not able to follow through with the classic meaningful disclosure that we've come to expect from corporate transactions. That's not there. I don't know what their defense is. I settle, right?
Well, and if the board of directors was doing their job, All right. So just think about this. Think about after the pedophile tweet goes out, there were a lot of people saying, well, where the fuck's the board? Why is this guy on Twitter? You know, why isn't the board stepping in and either telling him he can't tweet or he should be removed from Twitter or disciplining him or whatever any normal company board of directors would do? They would probably fire their CEO for making such a comment. I mean, could you imagine if the CEO of General Motors came out and called somebody a pedophile? She would be out. That would be it. It would be resignation next day. I mean, in this day and age, you can't even fucking there's zero margin for error when it comes for stuff like that. You look at the Me Too movement, you look at, you know, what has gone on with all of these people that have been in positions of power that have been ousted because of allegations and some of which have been proven true of bad behavior and, you know, sexual assault and all this nasty shit. And then this guy comes out and calls a guy a pedophile. You know, if Mary Barra comes out and does that, she's out. If Satya Nadella Satya Nadella comes out and does that, he's done the next day. So if the board was doing their fucking job to begin with, this may not have even happened today. Except the board is Kimball Musk and his merry band of brothers.
Yeah, I mean they're opening themselves to some truly unpleasant litigation were they not. Again, I'm just assuming they'll follow through with in some way. Again, they'll probably make their follow through opaque and problematic. I mean, given their track record, but assuming that something comes out, okay. But if it doesn't, the litigation they would be exposed to would be something, right? I mean, that's pretty much why you have lawyers. You know, just to, you know, that's talk about marginal utility. I mean, I would go find me a lawyer and talk about my loss from the $70 that I got jocked on or something when the stock collapses. I don't know.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I'm sorry that it happened today when we had already scheduled our podcast and that this had to be a forced topic of discussion because this isn't a Tesla exclusive podcast like everybody thinks it is. And I didn't, like I've said on previous podcasts, I try to avoid talking about it unless they give me a reason to. And certainly today there was a reason to. So nice to be able to pick your brain on it. So listen.
No, I mean, I know what I read, and I can try and, you know, I was playing around with their most recent Q, and, you look at that operating cash burn, and then you look at a couple of billion dollars being thrown onto that. That's, and maybe they can get something going. I don't know. Maybe they'll start kicking out those thousands of cars and filling those orders, and they're good looking cars. I don't know, I've never driven one. I don't have anybody. I live in little Wilmington, North Carolina. No one knows, any Tesla stuff around here, but I mean, they look great. I was just in Menlo Park last week and I saw a beautiful green Tesla and I was like, man, that's sporty. I never
doubted the aesthetics of the car. I've always said the aesthetics are nice, and I've always said the performance is nice. You know, I also said that if given the same amount of funding that Elon Musk was given, probably you could have gone out and produced that car. The question is, could you have turned around and sold it profitably?
Yep. You know, so. The next few days, right? I mean, we should know by close of business Wednesday, Eastern time, I guess.
Yeah, it should be an interesting story to follow. So listen, I want you to just, before we split here, give the listener one more kind of plug on your site, the site's address, how people can donate if they're interested, and what would be a piece of reading that you would recommend to somebody that isn't familiar with your work?
Sure. Well, the website is SIRF-online.org. We are a 501c3. Every donation is tax deductible. We have a PayPal button right on the site, and there's also a tab there that says donations, and that'll tell you if you want to reach out to us, we can arrange a wire. There's a mailing address for mail donations. We even have a brokerage account to handle any securities or capital market donations. So again, we're a 501c3 on that front. In terms of representative reading, I would look at, I am proud of that Valiant stuff. A story from October of 2015, the King's Gambit, which is Valiant's dirty little secret. That's the one where we exposed Philidor and what it was, and I think it, I think that that's important and good reading. And then I would just throw in, we have a search engine right on the site, and just throw in INSYS, INSYS. And you can see that, the freak show that company was. I mean, look, I'm proud of our most recent story on Acadia, where we highlighted some abusive, or some ignorant kind of actions by the SDA. So, I mean, it's kind of like asking a dad to pick his favorite kids, in public. So, but I look at the value of the INSYS stuff. You'll at least get a sense of, this is what this organization can do when we get it right. And I think that that's meaningful stuff.
Awesome. And do you have somebody that you read, that you enjoy reading, that you can recommend?
Yeah, I mean, it's not so brave of me, but I really like Bethany's stuff and Bill. I really think that they're more big picture, top down, this is how we got here writers. There's a guy at Crane's New York Business. I think his name is Aaron Elstein. Well, I know his name is Aaron Elstein. I think he does a great job of covering local New York issues, sort of a national focus, but with like a local flavor. And I would always say, if you can find Jesse Eisinger's stuff at ProPublica,
yeah, he does a great job.
I just think he's kind of like the Eric Clapton of this financial journalism gig. So, and Bill Alford at Barron's, I think that guy has got a track record that might be second to none in terms of picking off fraud. So, I put it though. Those are the people I read. I seek their stuff out, and I love it. So, again, maybe I am visiting my stuff on your readers, but you asked the question.
Yeah, that's what I wanted, though.
Yeah.
Listen, when the next story breaks, whatever it is, will you come back and we'll chat again?
Absolutely. It's a big honor, Chris, because you're a great guy and you're a good friend. And I really appreciate this.
It means a lot. We just got to know each other a couple of years ago, and I know we have a lot of mutual friends. You've been a kind person and a good good person to bounce ideas off of and ask questions about. I know I've asked you a lot of questions about writing and about style, and because I don't really have a formal background in journalism, but I do a fair amount of writing. So you've always been very helpful and just a great and very interesting person to talk to. So look forward to having you on again, and we'll talk to you soon. All right.
All right, my friend. Take care.
All right. Take care, Roddy. That was the one, the only, Roddy Boyd. From his website is surf-online.org. And as he said, you can go and you can read what he's got to say and decide for yourself if what he is putting out there is relevant to you. And if so, maybe even make a donation. Anyways, that's it for me today. I have, honestly, I'd like to go on for another half hour about this Tesla shit, but I have stuff I got to do tonight. And I think the next podcast will be after the next piece of relevant information drops, because I said pretty much everything I wanted to say to Roddy. So going to keep my eyes on the news and doing some reading tonight. But appreciate you guys tuning in. And again, thank you very much to my patrons for supporting. That donation for us goes a long way, and certainly it's the same for guys like Roddy who are donation-based as well. So we'll catch up to you soon. All right, peace.